This is Jeff Blankford. On this past December 28th, when street protests broke out across Iran and seized the attention of the White House, Congress, and the U.S. media, by the purest of coincidences, an Israeli television station broke the news that a secret agreement had been negotiated in Washington 2 weeks earlier between the U.S. and Israel to challenge Iran and its actions across the Middle East. As reported by the Times of Israel, citing a special report on Israel's Channel 10, Israel and the United States secretly signed a far-reaching joint memorandum of understanding providing for full cooperation to deal with Iran, quote, Iran's nuclear drive, its missile programs, and its other threatening activities, end quote. This report was confirmed in Washington and reported in the Israeli press, including its English language editions, but the only mention it merited at the time or since in the U.S. media was on this program and the relatively obscure online journal Business Insider. The document was signed on December 12th at the White House, quote, culminating intensive talks between representatives of the major Israeli and American intelligence and military hierarchies, headed by the U.S. and Israeli National Security Advisors H.R. McMaster and Meir Ben-Shabbat. Citing both American and Israeli officials, the Times of Israel said the document is designed to translate into, quote, steps on the ground, the position set out by U.S. President Donald Trump in his October 13 speech on Iran, in which he renewed his attacks on the agreement that the Obama administration had made with Iran and with members of the U.N. Security Council in Germany to reduce and curtail Iran's nuclear enrichment program. Citing both American and Israeli officials, the Times of Israel story said the document is designed to translate into, quote, steps on the ground, the position set out by U.S. President Donald Trump in his October speech. The fact that the U.S. media has suppressed this story may be as significant as the subject of the story itself, and I was hoping to be speaking with Grant Smith, the director of IRMEP, the Washington-based Institute for Research Middle East Policy. We're having some trouble with our phones and hope that we get Grant on the air. On March 2nd, Smith's Institute and the Washington Report on the Middle East Affairs will be co-hosting a conference of the National Press Club in Washington on the Israel lobby and American policy, which will feature an outstanding array of speakers that, like the secret agreement with Israel regarding Iran, is sure to get no coverage from the U.S. media. The evidence is more than conclusive. News and information that might reflect badly on Israel, the U.S. media will keep hidden from the American public. A notorious example that I have mentioned on Takes on the World in the past is the media's collective failure to report on the fabulously successful fundraising dinners held each year in Beverly Hills and New York for the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces. These dinners, held at the Beverly Hills Hilton and the Waldorf Astoria, feature top entertainers and well-known Hollywood stars and raise tens of millions of tax-exempt dollars from wealthy American Jews to promote the welfare of the Israel Defense Forces, a foreign army. The news that on each successive year, these dinners raise record-breaking amounts of money for the Israeli army, while tens of thousands of U.S. veterans are homeless in America's streets, would not go down well with a significant segment of Americans, and as such, it's obviously better from the Israeli perspective that they don't know about it. In November of last year, the dinner in Beverly Hills raised $53.8 million in a matter of a few hours, with the Oracle's Larry Ellison providing $16.6 million of that record number. That dinner and all the others in Beverly Hills are hosted by Israeli-American billionaire Haim Saban and his wife Cheryl, two of the biggest donors to the Democratic Party, and in particular to Bill and more recently Hillary Clinton. The Sabans, of course, can be counted on to kick in a few million dollars at each year's dinner for their favorite army. If you think the success of these dinners would merit a story or at least a headline somewhere besides in the Variety, Hollywood's trade organ, you'd be correct, but unaware of whose thumb is on the nation's media. The secret deal between the White House and Israel regarding Iran has far more sinister implications, however, than fundraisers by phony charities. According to the TV report and the Times of Israel, the two countries agreed to set up joint teams to handle various aspects of what was described as, quote, the Iranian threat. One such team, the report said, will deal with Iranian activity in Syria and Tehran's support for Hezbollah, which it described as, quote, a terrorist organization. Another joint team will deal with both diplomatic and intelligence activities designed to grapple, that's the Times of Israel's word, grapple, with Iran's nuclear weapons ambitions, despite the International Atomic Energy's conclusion that Iran is abiding by the terms of the nuclear deal and is making no effort to construct a nuclear weapon. A third joint team, it was reportedly agreed, would grapple with Iran's ballistic missile program and its efforts to build accurate missile systems in Syria and Lebanon. Finally, a fourth team would oversee preparation for any escalation by Iran and Hezbollah. McMaster and Ben Shabbat signed the joint agreement, the TV report said, quoting a, quote, senior U.S. government source and senior Israeli officials, end quote. Quoting Israeli officials, Channel 10 said, the meeting confirmed that the U.S. and Israel, quote, see eye to eye on the trends and processes in the region, end quote, and have now reached an agreement on the strategy and policy required to deal with them. With all due respect to President Trump's declaration on Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, Channel 10 reporter Barak Ravid predicted the December 12th, quote, dramatic understandings, end quote, would have a, quote, far greater impact on the security of Israel's citizens, end quote. About the rest of the world, he didn't say. Whether it had anything to do with Israel shooting down an Israeli Iranian drone over the weekend, which resulted in the Syrians downing an Israeli F-16, something they had not been able to do since 1982, remains to be seen. In Israel, quote, the downed F-16 prompted widespread hand-wringing and discussions about whether or not the Jewish state still maintains air superiority in the region, wrote the Times of Israel's Judah Ari Gross. So first, let's be clear, it doesn't, according to Gross. Israel, he wrote, hasn't had true air superiority in the region since late 2015, when Russia decided to install an S-400 missile defense battery in Syria, powerful enough to track the vast majority of Israeli airspace. Since then, Israel has effectively been operating in Syria by the grace of Moscow. A fly can't buzz above Syria without Russians' consent nowadays, an Israeli military official told the International Crisis Group think tank after the S-400 was installed. Still, wrote Gross, Israeli officials insist that the military is prepared to act with or without Russia's tacit approval, end quote. The F-16, a gift from Congress and U.S. taxpayers, was shot down on Saturday morning after it and seven other Israeli fighter jets took part in an airstrike on a military base near Palmyra in central Syria, from which the Israelis claim an Iranian operator flew an Iranian drone into Israeli territory an hour earlier. The downing of the F-16 might have ended a false notion of the Israeli forces' invincibility, but it does not have serious negative consequences for Israel's aerial dominance, Israeli experts say. Far more serious is the potential for Russia to end the policy it has maintained until now of not taking direct action against Israeli planes conducting airstrikes against targets in Syria. Quote, it does not appear to be the result of any kind of new Syria capability or unknown Israeli vulnerability, but some combination of human error, lucky timing, and perhaps a degree of hubris by the flight team, Brigadier General Amon Andar, head of the Israeli Air Force's Training and Doctrine Division, told the Idiot Aranat news site. There's no new issue that we hadn't previously identified. We operate in Syria continuously, conducting thousands of missions in Syria in just the last year, said the general, referring both to airstrikes and far more common reconnaissance operations. Well, a very different viewpoint was expressed by Haaretz columnist Gideon Levy, Israel's most well-known dissident journalist. He says, quote, Israeli arrogance might not have ended Saturday, but it surely cracked. Suddenly, wrote Levy, it became clear that Israel is not alone in the Middle Eastern skies, that even its immense military power has its limits. There could be a silver lining, he writes, if Israel accepted it cannot forever live by the sword, not even by advanced airplanes. Perhaps the F-16 that was downed took down with it the doctrine according to which everything can and should be resolved by force. First of all, force. Always force. Only force. Decades of air supremacy, and as often as in Lebanon and the Gaza Strip, air exclusivity, writes Levy, have led Israel to behave as if it is not the only the strongest power in the skies of the Middle East, but the only one. On Saturday, this assumption reached its end, wrote Levy. Israel is not alone in the sky, and the price is painful. The comic relief was when Israel claimed the Iranian drone had violated its sovereignty. Israel can violate anyone's sovereignty, wrote Levy. Overflowing Lebanon, bombing in Syria, Sudan, and of course helpless Gaza. But only the Iranian drone violated sovereignty, end quote. Well, that was from Gideon Levy writing in Haaretz, who will be among the speakers at that conference in Washington on the Israel lobby and American policy at the National Press Club on March 2nd. More about that later. Meanwhile, complicating the situation and not unlikely, raising the threat of a wider war and an Israeli military strike, the Israeli police yesterday recommended that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu be indicted on bribery and breach of trust charges in two alleged corruption cases. The recommendation, made public on Tuesday evening, comes after year-long investigations into the two alleged corruption cases. State prosecutors must now decide whether or not to file indictments. Netanyahu, in an address to the nation Tuesday, maintained his innocence, saying the recommendations, quote, cast a dark shadow, end quote, and have no place in a democratic state, end quote. I will keep working for the good of the country, not for cigars from a friend, and not for better media coverage, he said, responding to the accusations. The latter is a reference to a recorded conversation between Netanyahu and the publisher of Yedid Ahronot, Israel's best-selling newspaper, in which the publisher was told that if he ran stories favorable to the prime minister, he would see to it that his paper would get less competition from Israel Hayom, a free national newspaper with a wider circulation, and that paper is owned by Netanyahu's close friend and supporter, the American Jewish billionaire, casino owner Sheldon Adelson, who, it should be remembered, donated $25 million to the campaign of Donald Trump. The Israeli prime minister said he is sure he'll be reelected in the next national elections, which are scheduled for November 2019. As the situation in Syria heats up among all the players, including Israel, the United States so far have limited their exchanges to a war of words. However, signs aren't encouraging that it will end there, notes Al-Monitor's Metin Gürkan. Quote from Gürkan, decision makers in Ankara have toughened their rhetoric against the United States, and many senior figures in the ruling Justice and Development Party, AKP, are hinting at the possibility of armed confrontation between Turkish and U.S. soldiers. If the U.S. soldiers wear the garb of terrorists and hang around with them, and if they attack Turkish soldiers, no doubt we will not have a chance to distinguish between them, Deputy Prime Minister Bekir Bozdak said last week. In a February 6th speech before AKP parliamentarians, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said, speaking to the United States, get out of Manbij. We will come there to deliver the land to its true owners, end quote. Turkey started its assault on Afrin in northern Syria, to drive out the Kurds, specifically the People's Protection Unit called the YPG. Ankara appears insistent on expanding the Afrin offensive in Minbij, about 60 miles east, after gaining full control of the area west of the Euphrates River. The United States, for its part, points out Gürkan, sounds determined not to abandon Minbij, even though it has no permanent military outposts there. As Ankara hardened its stance, he reported, a coalition including Lieutenant General Paul Funk and Major General James Jarrett of the U.S. Army visited Minbij on February 7th and had plenty to say. Quote, we're very proud of our positions there, here, and we want to make sure everyone knows it, said Gerard, the special operations commander for the U.S.-led coalition against the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. You hit us, we will respond aggressively. We will defend ourselves, Funk added, raising the stakes. An armed confrontation, February 7th, between U.S.-backed democratic forces and President Bashar al-Assad's forces backed by Russia, escalated to a major battle in Deir ez-Zor, an oil-rich town eastern Syria. U.S. warplanes were involved, and a number of Russian paramilitary private contractors were reportedly killed, although the Russians deny it. Yet another sign the U.S. intends to hold on to the territory it has brought under its control in the post-ISIS setting. is an armed confrontation in Manbij between Turkish and U.S. soldiers representing the two largest armies in NATO really a possibility? Well, the key consideration here, observes our monitors Metin Gürgen, is whether Turkey is genuinely willing to challenge the United States militarily in Syria. Or, he asks, is Ankara's increasingly aggressive rhetoric just part of its effort to deter the U.S. military from working more closely with the Kurdish YPG in Manbij? Of course, nobody seems ready to ask the question, by what right does the United States have to have any troops at all in Syria? Well, since last year's elections, there's been increasing conversation about how these times bring to mind the novel 1984 by the British writer George Orwell, first published in 1949 in response to the rise of totalitarian societies in the wake of World War II. Last Thursday, I attended the opening of an extraordinarily powerful adaptation of Orwell's novel at the Ukiah Players Theater, directed by Chris Douthat, with an outstanding cast of local performers. It was a sobering experience that pulled no punches, and one that I recommend to all of you in the sound of my voice. Performances of 1984 are scheduled on Friday and Saturday nights, with Sunday matinees through the 4th of March at the Ukiah Players Theater on Low Gap Road across from Ukiah High School. I really recommend it. I was then able to connect Grant Smith to the board, so I went on with the program. He could hear me, so rather than an interview with Grant Smith at this point in time, I'm going to read an article that he posted today about the subject of censorship on the part of the Israel lobby. So I'm going to tell him that, and we will move on with the program. And the headline is a story, Will Al Jazeera Air the Lobby Before AIPAC Meets? AIPAC is going to the largest U.S. lobby in terms of foreign lobby that doesn't register as a foreign agent is going to have its annual conference next month in Washington, at which two-thirds of the members of Congress are supposed to be among the 20,000 attending that conference, including major speakers, including Benjamin Netanyahu, but also the leaders of the U.S. Senate from both political parties, because support for Israel is a bipartisan affair, but also the editor of Breitbart News will be a featured speaker because AIPAC is moving in that direction as the country or the leadership in Washington has moved in that direction. At that AIPAC conference, the members who attend have their names read off one by one. So those who have money to support America's by America's politicians, unique in America, will be able to know who to send money to when the election rolls around later in the year. But here is the article that Grant Smith has written today for be posted on the internet. The Israel lobby, writes Grant, has a lot of levers it can push and pull to curry favorable news coverage from media organizations. These range from denying access to the limited pool of top-tier pundits and Israeli government officials to crippling economic boycotts. This power is visible in the battle to punish and shutter Al Jazeera, the Qatar-based state-funded news organization. Al Jazeera's undercover investigated series, The Lobby, stunned both UK and US viewers last year. The product of a six-month 2016 undercover investigation, the four-part series revealed the Israeli embassy's close guidance of allegedly, quote, independent pro-Israel UK domestic organizations, unfounded accusations of anti-Semitism lodged against Labour Party members, and coordinated efforts to take down lawmakers deemed hostile to Israel. The series led to the dismissal of Shai Masot, a shadowy Israeli embassy official profiled in part four of the series, and apologies from the Israeli embassy. Less well known, Grant Smith goes on, is that concurrent to the UK investigation, another undercover reporter was hard at work penetrating Israel's Washington lobby, James Anthony Kleinfeld, a British citizen interned at the Israel Project. The Israel Project works as a quasi-public relations agency for Israel, using its cartel-like access to sought-after Israeli officials to shape media appearances and influence who can appear opposite Israel's media luminaries. The behind-the-scenes activity of the Israel Project's chief, former Israeli American-Israel Public Affairs Committee spokesperson Josh Block, to condition and ultimately quash the appearance of Rula Jibril, a Palestinian, on Voice of America were exposed via a Freedom of Information Act request in 2016. Kleinfeld reportedly gained access to the Israel Project's donor information by asking to work in donor development, a position not normally given to interns. Not much is known about the source of the nonprofit 501c3, the Israel Project funding. That, by the way, is a charity. Imagine that, a charity, right? The Israel Project's funding. Under the leadership of founder Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi, donations grew from $1.8 million in 2003 and peaked at nearly $20 million in 2010. Donations fell to $8.7 million in 2016 after the Israel Project received stinging rebukes from more established Israel lobbying organizations over its claims to be a one-stop shop leading all major branches of Israel advocacy. The Internal Revenue Service claims it cannot locate any of the publicly releasable PDF documents the Israel Project presented in its application for tax-exempt status for social welfare purposes it allegedly serves. Almost immediately, Grant Smith writes, following the airing of the lobby, as in Britain, the government of Qatar, which owns Al Jazeera, suddenly faced an intense coordinated campaign accusing it of supporting terrorism, being too close to Iran, and demanding that Al Jazeera be shut down. The quote-unquote Qatar diplomatic crisis is not easily traceable directly back to Israel or the lobby's intense displeasure over the UK investigative report or to fears that the U.S. edition would be released. The countries that first cut off diplomatic relations with Qatar were Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and Egypt. However, the Qatari government soon came to its own conclusion that exiting the crisis demanded wooing the Western pro-Israel lobby. The Emirates sent a series of invitations to Mort Klein, head of the Zionist Organization of America, one of the oldest Israel advocacy organizations in the U.S., to visit the Emirate beginning in September of 2017. Klein lobbied the Obama administration to cancel Qatar Airways landing rights in the United States to escalate the crisis. The airline last reported annual revenue was $10.6 billion, and with $538 million in profits and 43,000 employees. Other Israel advocates such as Alan Dershowitz visited the Emirates along with leaders of the American Jewish Congress and Conference of Presidents of major American Jewish organizations. Many demanded that Qatar cut ties to Hamas, the Taliban, and Iran, but this may have been cover for their principal aim to shutter Al Jazeera and keep the U.S. series from airing. Work is currently underway to convince the Department of Justice to order Al Jazeera to register as a foreign agent, limiting its access to facilities and U.S. government officials. Such activities have generated back-page stories claiming that Al Jazeera finally promised the wave of Israel lobbyists it would not air the now somewhat aging The Lobby U.S. edition. The most sensible time to release it would be just before AIPAC convenes in Washington in early March. But many in the pro-Israel ecosystem grew alarmed, writes Grant Smith, when Al Jazeera sent letters requesting comments on its U.S. investigative series to Israel lobby organizations in early February. Such letters are commonplace before big investigative pieces air. Qatari Foreign Minister Sheikh Mohammed Al Thani claimed Qatar's constitution forbids any interference in the media. Whether Al Jazeera finally broadcasts the U.S. series of the lobby before AIPAC convenes will reveal whether it remains true to its upstart, quote, take no prisoners reporting, or has become as beholden to orchestrated Israel lobby pressure campaigns as mainstream U.S. media organizations and its fellow government-owned outlets like the Voice of America. That's Grant Smith on this same subject of the Israel lobby broadcast in Al Jazeera. And the Jewish publication Tablet today, article called Qatar and American Jews, news about inflammatory documentary breaks just as a charm offensive is underway. What does Doha, that's Qatar's capital, really want? By Armin Rosen, he writes, quote, on the February 2nd, Philip Reese, a Doha-based manager of investigations at Al Jazeera, who I've actually interviewed once, sent letters to several U.S.-based Jewish and pro-Israel organizations, along with various current and former employees of those organizations, informing them that they will likely be featured in a documentary, quote, concerning the role of pro-Israel advocacy groups in the United States, end quote. Qatar-based Al Jazeera is a subsidiary of the regime-owned Qatar Media Corporation. The February 2nd letters confirm that an agent of the network had secretly recorded pro-Israel activists, end quote. As one letter recipient explained, the vast majority of people in Washington hold insignificant jobs in insignificant organizations. Quote, no one ever walks into these places and says, tell me how important you are. Little surprised that a charming and seemingly earnest British-accented 23-year-old polyglot was able to get other 23-year-olds, to exaggerate about their organization's activities or explain how they thought things really worked in the pro-Israel world, end quote. If the documentary runs, it is an absolute certainty that there will be some kind of effort in Congress and the pro-Israel community to make Al Jazeera register under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, FARA. This past week, New Jersey Congressman Josh Gottheimer, happens to be Jewish, began circulating a letter that called on the Justice Department to explore the issue further, citing, quote, Al Jazeera's record of radical anti-American, anti-Semitic, and anti-Israel broadcasts. Now, that's called chutzpah, because none of these Israeli advocacy organizations have registered or have been asked to register since 1963 as agents of what they are of the Israeli government. And they're able to get away with registering as 501c3 charities, which means anyone giving money to them, those donations are tax exempt. So you give money to the Israel Project and is tax exempt. Now, AIPAC is a 501c4, which means your donations to them are not tax exempt, but Israel, but the AIPAC pays no taxes. So if you want to talk about occupied territory, and I talk about Washington being occupied territory, it is Israel's most important occupied territory. And the idea that because Al Jazeera is exposing the Israel lobby for what it is, they will have to register their foreign agent, just like RT has had to register the foreign agent because they don't go along with the neocons' line of thinking about Israel, Russia, and the Middle East. I should mention that it's not widely known, but President John Kennedy challenged Israel in several different ways. One, he was the first and last president to support the right of return for Palestinians to their homeland. At that time, there were 700,000 approximately, and he said at least 100,000 would have to go back. This is a red line Israel could not afford to have happen. Secondly, he adamantly opposed Israel's nuclear weapons program and was furious at Ben-Gurion setting up what they call Potemkin villages, phony laboratories to make it appear that Israel's nuclear program was peaceful. It wasn't. But finally, maybe the most important thing that Israel objected to was Kennedy's request of the Justice Department under his brother Bobby to force the American Zionist Council, which was the father or the predecessor to AIPAC. It's more complicated than that, but I'll explain in a moment, to register as a foreign agent in 1962. And in 1963, Senator William Fulbright, very famous senator for whom the Fulbright scholarships were named, held hearings that you never hear about. But Grant Smith has written about it. He's the only person to write about them. Held hearings in which it turned out that money donated to Israel by Jewish Americans and by others who support Israel was being funneled back to the United States to buy propaganda in the United States promoting Israel. And this basis was one of the bases for calling on the American Zionist Council, which was run by an Israeli citizen, Canadian-born Israeli, actually, who registered as a foreign agent, Cy Kennan, to register as a foreign agent. And during 63, after these hearings, the Justice Department lawyers tried to get the American Zionist Council to do that, and the American Zionist Council's lawyers obfuscated and obfuscated until that day on November 22nd, 1963. Kennedy was taken out, taken from us, and Lyndon Johnson, who was a great friend of Israel, the greatest up to that point, did not pursue the case, and his Justice Department replacement for Bobby Kennedy, Nicholas Katzenbach, did not push it, and no American president has made any effort to get the Israel lobby, any organization in the Israel lobby, to register as a foreign agent. A number of years ago, Grant Smith went to, and I was in Washington at the time, went with him to the Farah Department, the Foreign Agent Registration Agency, which was going to give us an hour, myself and several other people, to make the case that AIPAC, which was the successor to American Zionist Council, should register. Grant brought with him 360 pages of documents, which made it quite clear that AIPAC was an Israeli agent functioning for Israel. And the head of the department, a woman named Heather Hunt, appeared to be very taken with Grant's arguments, as were two employees of hers, and it appeared that we were making great progress. At that point, the hour became 2 hours. Meanwhile, at the far end of the table was someone sitting who did not give us his card, just watching everything. And when it seemed that things were going in the direction that he didn't want, that the department appeared to be moving toward agreeing that AIPAC should have to register as a foreign agent, this man spoke up and said, well, wait a minute, don't rush into things. Before we go further, we have to have somebody from AIPAC come here and admit it, which, of course, meant that this thing wasn't going anywhere, and that was no more communications from the Foreign Agents Registration Agency, which apparently is another occupied territory, occupied by the Israel lobby or by Israel and its agents. And this may sound really outrageous over the air, but the evidence is overwhelming, and you're not going to hear this even discussed anywhere else, at least on public radio, and that's one of the things that KZYX provides, an outlet for information you are not going to hear or not likely to find out anywhere else on public radio. And as I say, if you want to know who this is, you just tuned in. This is Jeff Blankford. I'm host of Takes on the World. And we were hoping to have this interview today with Grant Smith to talk about the latest censorship by the Israel lobby over the U.S. media about a secret deal that the U.S. and Israel cooked up on December 12th in Washington between the intelligence agencies of both governments to target Iran and do what it could to undermine Iran's activities in the Middle East that Israel and the U.S. don't approve of. And this was in the Israeli media. It was on Israeli television. It was confirmed its existence by Washington. It was in the Israeli press, no doubt in the European press, but not in the American press, because obviously Israel and the Israel lobby and U.S. government does not want to know the degree to which Israel and the U.S. are in cahoots and maybe in starting a war with Iran, provoking another war in the Middle East, which the United States seems entrenched there forever as Israel's close ally or maybe surrogate, because we have adopted all of Israel's allies as our own. We passed resolutions attacking and punishing Hezbollah, which has not attacked the United States, does not threaten to attack the United States, and yet it's very likely that this administration will be the first in which Israeli soldiers and American soldiers will fight side by side with no objections from the corrupt Arab states who are now also in bed with Israel. It's very difficult times, not being discussed anywhere in the U.S. media, at least on public radio, except on this radio program. And so you're hearing something. If you go and check it out, you're not going to find this reported anywhere else. It is too tender a subject. And when the Israel lobby is mentioned, people say, oh, you're going to provoke anti-Semitism. One pro-Palestinian activist in Britain wrote to me. He said, what happens when you are promoting and talking about the power of the Israel lobby is the first step to Holocaust denial, as if one thing has anything to do with the other. But that's a way of intimidating people from even discussing the subject, be they Jewish or not Jewish. It's something they would rather not talk to because it gets very uncomfortable because of the history of World War II and before that of a history of anti-Semitism, which is being used as a club by the Israel lobby to prevent people from actually knowing what Israel's doing and actually shaming the people who perished at the hands of the Nazis in World War II. So this is something that I've talked about. Grant Smith has written a number of books about this issue. You don't hear him interviewed anywhere. He's had five conferences in Washington with major speakers, some of whom you have heard on Democracy Now!, some of whom you have heard on NPR, but you never hear. When these conferences take place right in Washington, the National Press Club, one time C-SPAN actually did come in and film the whole day, but they got the word they didn't film that again. The conferences are live streamed and available on your computer, and will remain there. But I want to give you an idea who's going to be speaking on March 2nd. First, Lawrence Wilkerson, who is the aide to Colin Powell and now has become one of the most important and strongest critics of U.S. foreign policy. You heard him just the other day on Democracy Now! I have heard him on NPR, but Wilkerson is going to be speaking on March 2nd on the subject, is the U.S. ramping up its military presence in Syria and preparing to attack Iran for Israel? Now, you're not going to find that question asked anyplace else or discussed anyplace else but at this conference in Washington, March 2nd. Also speaking, as I mentioned, will be the Israeli dissident journalist Gideon Levy. He's going to speak on the Zionist tango, step left, step right. When I was there as a speaker at one of these conferences, at the same time Gideon Levy was there, Benjamin Netanyahu had just given a speech to the joint session of Congress, and in which he was attacking President Obama's position on Iran. And Gideon Levy was astounded that this could happen in the United States. He said, this is the United States of Israel. We're not going to hear that anyplace else but on this program. Other journalists are going to be there. Virginia Tilley, who writes in the Middle East and Africa, does the U.S. support an apartheid state? Ian Williams, a reporter, covers the U.N., the Israel lobby in the U.N. Two Palestinians who I happen to know for a long time, Rabab Abu Hadi, a professor at San Francisco University, is going to speak how and why the Israel lobby is suppressing free speech and academic freedom on college campuses, and believe me, it is. And Nora Arakat, who is now a lawyer in Washington and a spokesperson for Palestinian people who I've known for many years. She's going to speak how support for Israel's violations of international law puts the U.S. on the wrong side of history. Barry Trachtenberg will be speaking, challenging the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, pushing back against Jewish exceptionalist politics. This is an act Israel lobby is pushing Congress to pass an act that would make boycotting, calling for a boycott, divestment, and sanctions from Israel against the law. It actually is in a number of states, including California, where only one member of the Assembly and Senate had the guts to vote against it, because not only is the Congress occupied, but so is the California Senate and Assembly, and that of half the states, almost half the states in the Union, who have passed similar acts making boycotting of Israel a violation of business acts. So if you're a corporation, a company that won't sell to Israel or buy from Israel, you cannot do business with the state of California or Ohio, New York, Pennsylvania. I could go down the list. This is the conference coming up March 2nd. I hope to be playing some excerpts from this on a future program, and I also will have Grant Smith back on my program. This was a really important subject. Imagine that here is a deal struck by Israel and the United States that could lead to a war with Iran, and there's no discussion. Do you remember the secret war in Laos? Well, it wasn't a secret to the people of Laos or the people of Indochina or the people of Europe or the media in Europe. They knew the U.S. was bombing Laos. So this is not, at this point, similar to the bombing of Laos, but here it is. This deal, which was publicized in the Israeli press, no doubt in the European media, because they don't have the same kind of censorship of what goes on in the mainstream media as we have here. Everyone knows about it, but the United States, people in the United States don't know about it. So you have Donald Trump, who wavers back and forth. How much he has to do with this, we don't know. He, of course, went out of his way to say Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, which flies in the face of UN resolutions and the opinions of every other developed country. One other country, I believe, one of these little tin horn dictatorships that we've installed after overthrowing its government, they have recognized Israel, a capital of Jerusalem. But that's it. And some of the U.S. colonies in the Pacific. But this is what doesn't get discussed. You have the case of this young teenage Palestinian woman, Ahmed Tamimi. Back in December, a few hours after her cousin, her 15-year-old cousin, was shot in the face with a rubber bullet. A rubber bullet is a bullet covered with rubber, and blasted, just destroyed the left side of his face. The picture of his face was absolutely horrible. This diminutive Palestinian young teenager at 16, was slapped and kicked an Israeli soldier. And it was videoed. He didn't hit her back, excuse me, but it was quite obvious her blows had no effect on him. And when the video went viral, the Israelis went crazy, and the things they had to say about her, what should happen to her in prison, and that her whole family should be in prison. Well, actually, this happened in December. She is in prison with her mother, who also supported her and put the video on YouTube, on social media. They have been held in prison, and yesterday they have been, their prison term has been extended without trial yet through March. And this happened in December, and she's now, Ahmed Tamimi is now turned 17. Can you imagine if she was an Israeli girl or from any other country, and some other country was beating up on her? And calling for her to be, and her family to be in prison for life, as some Israeli politicians have done, is an extraordinary story. And you heard a bit of it yesterday on NPR for the first time. But it's a story that's all over the world today. And the Israelis are embarrassed about it, so they don't want the American media to know about it. They don't want the American public to know about it. And that is an incredible power that they have over our media, over our society and our country. And it's just, it doesn't represent the Jewish community. It represents a handful of Jewish Americans, and supported by Christian evangelicals, 30 million of them, who put Israel's interests before those of the United States. And this is something that needs to be talked about. I've talked about it a number of times in this program. I've had a number of guests. Grant Smith has talked about it. This conference at the National Press Club in Washington, that's going to be March 2nd, and it will be streamed if you go to IRMEP, I-R-M-E-P, I-R-M-E-P.org. You can get all the information on it, and you can also see speeches from press conferences, including you can see me speaking as well. This is something that needs to get around, needs to be circulated, because otherwise we are heading perhaps for another war for Israel, which the Iraq certainly was. It was organized, orchestrated by the neocons who set up a special office in the Pentagon, Office of Special Plans, in which they manufactured the false evidence that justified the United States going to war against a country, Iraq, that never harmed us, a war that not only destroyed that country but destabilized the region and has led to the flow of millions of refugees out of the Middle East and later North Africa with the overthrowing of Gaddafi in Libya, and has led to the rise, thanks to the xenophobia of the Europeans not wanting to see brown and black Muslims from North Africa and the Middle East coming to their countries. This has led to the rise of right-wing, extreme right-wing parties in Europe, all stemming from the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. This is Jeff Blankford. You know, I'm on. I could talk for quite a long time, but the time is running down. Next Wednesday, February 21st, in the midst of our fund drive, I will be back here with another Takes on the World, joined by phone by Forthright Radio's Joy DeClaire, asking for your pledges and support our community radio station and the kind of programming she and I have been bringing you for more years than we can count. My guest will be Istanbul-based American journalist Susie Hansen, who will be speaking, who you may have heard here in September, and we'll be speaking about Turkey's actions against the Kurds in Syria that have led to a conflict with Washington, and about her extraordinary, extraordinary book, Notes on a Foreign Country, An American Abroad in a Post-American World, which we will be offering to you as a premium. That is next Wednesday, so be sure to tune in. This book, I say, is very extraordinary. It's a thin book. I mean, relatively thin. It's about 250 pages. But it goes back and covers all the U.S. interventions going back to Greece and following World War II. It's extraordinary, and is a memoir at the same time, and she meets some extraordinary people, some of whom I met. It is like a revelation. It's a book I can not more strongly recommend, and we'll be talking with Susie again, Hansen, next week, and so be sure to tune in. And please get ready to contribute to this station in our important fundraising program. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting KZOX. And-